My guest today is Stephanie Rose, the artist, who's going to be having a show in Albany at the Albany Institute of History and Art, opening in September.
It opens on the 25th of August, and it'll be up at regular museum hours, but the opening event itself is September 27th.
And it has a long run.
5 months.
5 months.
Yeah.
Now, how did this come about?
Well, the Albany Institute, I'm fortunate to say, started acquiring my work some time ago, and then they gave an event at which I gave a lecture on my work from 63 to the present, and more impressively, Carter Radcliffe gave a wonderful talk on my work. And it was really great. And after that, they asked me if I would do a show, and they asked specifically for a portrait show, so which was interesting to me because that's pretty recent in my first portrait was in 96. My first show of portraits was in New York in 99. I mean, I started showing in 73. So, I mean, I've been painting all my life, but we don't talk about juvenilia. So.
And you were an abstract painter until that time? Until...
Absolutely.
I see.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I never would have thought that that I would paint portraits, but...
And how did you start doing
that? Well, my daughter was about to turn 29, and I wanted to think of something, you know, special for her birthday. So I thought of, I'd paint her. And that's really how it started. I thought that would be the only portrait. But that's, it turned out, I mean, it was really odd. I mean, there was a private dealer who came through my studio while I was working on her portrait, and he said he had a client who liked my work and loved portraits and would I consider a commission, and I figured it beats tap dancing down Broadway, so I said yes, you know. And I, you know, when I painted this young woman, I realized there was a natural theatrical extension between what I do as a painter and making portraiture. And that was unexpected, and it made me curious, and I started asking friends if I might paint them. So that's really how it started. The second portrait was the commission, but the third portrait was my friend Ted Mooney. And Ted, the, you know, very distinguished novelist who... Ted was a senior editor at Art in America for 33 years. He left the magazine a few years ago. But, you know, Ted thinks I'm the most critical person in the world, and I think he is, so I thought it would be really scary to paint Ted. And that's why I asked him. And that went pretty well. I think his remark to me was that the painting was more him than he is. So I figured, well, okay, you know. And then I thought, what could be scarier than painting Ted? And I thought, I'd ask John Ashbery. It really went well, though. I mean, actually, that's the first painting that my portrait of John Ashbery is the first painting that the Albany Institute acquired, you know, of my work.
And at this point, there are, I think you told me, maybe 25 portraits?
In the show, there will be, I'm pretty sure there are about 25 paintings. Two of them, however, are not portraits. They will be, the two that aren't are large-scale paintings that are abstract. And I think that the connection between that work and the portraiture will be, you know, a valuable, also a theatrical element, which really suits me. My abstract work at this point is always abstract in context, notwithstanding the fact that there are recognizable imagery. My work contains representational imagery, recognizable imagery. Nevertheless, the context always remains abstract. You know, you might look at the work and think you perceive a narrative, but in fact, there isn't one.
Well, there's a kind of play between, as the one essay by Carter Radcliffe, the foreground, middle ground, and background are kind of always playing together, right?
Always, but I see each element as a character in a play. You know, even the background has a particular characteristic, if you will. And that element has changed, for the most part, up until fairly recently. My portrait subjects were always in non-specific space. More recently, the space is more defined, although it isn't realistic. But it's more, it would be more familiar because it has, perspectival aspects to it, even though they're incongruous. But I mean, the way that the space is treated in the more recent portraits is not unrelated to my other work, because there are always disjunctive elements spatially and in terms of scale and in terms of, you know, pictorial reference, architectural reference, filmic references. They are all disjunctive relationships that are made to come together. I mean, you know, within a single work.
And obviously color has always been a major element
Oh, absolutely. Even when, I mean, I've made paintings that are almost grisaille paintings that I love that. I have no parochial views or tastes whatsoever. So it's all color. I mean, in the 70s, I made, for many years, I made a very reductive paintings that were, you know, not high in color at all. I mean, but you know, they were very, very subdued. But that's, you know, it's I don't differentiate in terms of the color. Whatever the real right color is for the painting is what it is. There's no other way to gauge it.
Now, back when you were in school, did you have a particular artist that you wanted to emulate or that you admired especially?
Well, okay. If you want to go really back far, I would, because I did make a painting of this person, but all right. I knew I was a painter when I was a little kid. I knew I was a painter when I was 7. It was an irrational and absolute moment where it occurred to me. I know that the painters that I loved as a child, and certainly I was a teenage surrealist, you know, there's no, you know, you can't escape it. But no, the painters that I loved as a child, El Greco particularly, were not as powerful an influence. I would say the most resounding influence on my sensibility is Michael Powell, the film director. The Red Shoes, Peeping Tom, A Matter of Life and Death, Black Narcissus, Thief of Baghdad, I Know Where I'm Going, Tales of Hoffman. You know, I mean, this is a, he was a genius and had a such an extraordinary visual point of view. I mean, there are other aspects, there are messages that have come through certain of his films, which I won't talk about publicly, that also I discovered to my horror had a tremendous influence on me psychologically. Never mind all of that. One gets over oneself or not. But the influence on my development visually is definitely begins with Powell. And weirdly, later on in my career, there was so much synchronicity, even before, because it was a long time before I knew Peeping Tom, which is a late work of his. Film is 1960. That film that came out the same year as Psycho was banned, actually. It really halted his career drastically, and because people thought it was so shocking. But it's also, it's Shakespearean. I mean, and it's a great influence on films that come after it. And, I mean, I don't think you could have Mean Streets, Reservoir Dogs. I mean, there are so many, there's so much of David Lynch's lighting in certain films. There's so much that comes out of Powell in the history of narrative film in the 20th and 21st centuries. I mean, it's still happening, you know. So certainly I'm not alone in having been affected by Powell. There's a lot of synchronistic stuff. I mean, painting him was, that was the most challenging painting I've ever made, because I had to keep continually reminding myself that through my entire life, he exerted an influence, and I never had to, I was never thinking about it when I was painting. Never thinking about it, you know. And all of a sudden, when I decided that I absolutely had to paint him, you know, there was this, as Bloom would put it, anxiety of influence, where I had to say, you know, like, my job is not to reproduce Hein Heckroth's brilliant decors. You know, I mean, the sets are just beyond belief, you know, in some of these films, especially Tales of Hoffman and The Red Shoes. It's just unimaginably brilliant. But you know, so that was very challenging, not to mention the fact that the reference material was very difficult to read, to understand his facial structure, because I never work from one photograph, even on a living person. You know, I always work from a lot of different ones, so that whatever pose I come up with or expression is really something that communicates psychological presence. You might not find that in just one picture, you know. So that was hard to arrive at, and I was looking at pictures of him from his 20s up until his 80s.
How much time do you put into a painting?
That painting took 4 months. Usually I don't remember, because it's like, you know, it's like something traumatic to remember how long something took. You know, I always think, when I start a painting, I always think it's going to go a lot faster, because I always feel like I'm just getting shot out of a cannon, and I'm, you know, like, and, you know, I don't paint that fast.
Now, do you work on one painting at a time?
For most of my life, I have. There have been times that I haven't. But that's with smaller paintings. Although in recent years, actually, I've worked on more than one painting at a time when something came up where I had to, you know, a commission, for example, and it didn't stop me from working on something else. Or I would go back to a painting, and then I would be working on that at the same time I was working on another painting. So, you know, but these recent paintings, I've never been fast, but these have been, they're different. Everything is always changing. It's harder to talk about something when you're not done with it. You know, when you, I mean, you make a painting, you're flying by the seat of your pants. At least me, I'm guided by curiosity. I'm not interested in, you know, repeating something. I want to see what happens next. And, you know, there are certain elements that recur, and I will let them come up until they don't come up anymore, naturally. If I know too much about something, then I will let go of it, because I would rather be flying by the seat of my pants and be, you know, looking for something that I, where I don't know what it is until I find it. You know, I mean, I love theater. I've been privileged to design for theater. A completely different process. It is for sure an inventive process. But, you know, you have a plan with design. There's a plan that you have, and you follow through until completion. You know, in theater, you're illuminating someone else's text. You know, if you're designing furniture, you or a building, you better do it so that nobody drops dead, you know, from the thing crashing on you. So, you know, yeah, you have to plan certain things that you don't have to plan in a painting.
Do you keep do you paint regular hours? Do you have certain times you like to paint?
I like to start in the morning. I don't like to stop particularly. For most of my life, a 9 to 11 hour day is really works for me, with, you know, like little food breaks. Lately, there's been a lot of other stuff that I've had to deal with, you know, obstacle courses that everybody else has in their life. I have too, but the paintings are changing, and that has slowed my pace, I think. And I have found that I don't stop for a lunch break, because I feel like my IQ goes down to 2 of a plant life after I eat, you know, room temperature or something. And I feel like I'm not going to have that level of clarity and energy. And I worry about, especially I think this year with, you know, knowing that there were deadlines coming up, I was really worried about not painting, you know, about painting after I eat. So it also meant, you know, a 5 or 6 hour work day. Sometimes I'd be able to come back, but sometimes I really was like, you know, not going to be able to work. I would have to, like, do something else.
I've kind of wondered about that myself, that your blood sort of goes into a different direction.
Yeah, I usually, if I have to do any writing, which is something that I do for various reasons, you know, at different times of my, you know, at different times, I prefer not to be writing on a day that I'm painting. Painting is not an intellectual procedure. You know, it's not, I mean, all the balls are up in the air at the same time, but basically, I mean, because your intellect comes into play, but I don't think it comes into play in the actual process. I think there are things that happen where you gauge whether something works in a painting or not, and that's, you know, partly empirical, you know, I mean, it's partly experiential and existential. It's a gut thing, and intuition is the highest form of intelligencing, so I'm not going to put that down, you know. I mean, Einstein solved the theory of relativity in his sleep. I mean, it wasn't like he didn't do his homework, but, you know. But you do have to trust your unconscious mind. But I think that, you know, some cognitive rational process comes into play if you're deciding whether or not something works in a painting. Do you keep it in? Do you let go of it? You know. But also you have to have an internalized sense of if you're being faithful to the direction that you feel the painting is taking. And this is, you know, this is not a pie-in-the-sky thing. It sounds like it because it's abstruse. But abstruse, you know, something that's abstruse, it may be mysterious and abstract, but it can be decoded. You know, it doesn't, you know, it's not unattainable in terms of insight and understanding. So,
do you use oil paints? Oil paints?
The paintings are oil. Some passages, not every passage, but some passages are underpainted in acrylic. Some very, very intensely. Some less so. It really depends on what the passage needs and what I need to be able to read through. Or not at the next stage or when the oil is introduced. But they are, in fact, oil paintings, yeah. Yeah. The you know, there isn't a painting where where there's a passage that's acrylic that still stands. That occasionally that'll happen in a work on paper. In a work on paper, there may be a combination of elements, and there may be a passage that I will leave.
Do you do a lot of work on paper?
I do, but I usually do it. That will happen when I'm not making paintings on canvas. I usually, if I'm working on paper, that's usually an exclusive, venture.
And I know that the two paintings are quite tall, eight feet high. The more abstract ones. How about the portraits? What size?
Well, none of the portraits are that big, but there are certainly ones that are 6 feet. I don't think there are any that are bigger than 6 feet in the height or the width.
And do you stretch the canvas yourself?
No. No. I'm so glad I don't. I really, when I taught college and graduate school for almost 30 years, and I certainly know how to teach someone how to stretch a canvas, but I don't really like doing it, and I know there are people that are a lot better at it than I am. So, plus I'm short, but I don't really like making excuses.
Do you have that done here or in New York?
It depends. I've been working with the same stretcher maker since 72 or 73, and Laura Westby, she's wonderful, and she's a painter.
And you you have a studio that's separate from your living space.
Oh, yeah, I do, which was kind of weird because at home in New York, the studio and the living space were right together. So it was, I know this is going to sound really fruity, but it was jarring for me to have to walk out of the house a few steps into a different building, because it's an outbuilding, my studio. I mean, I'm really lucky. And all my work is stored there, that I have on hand. But it's not the same. It isn't the same. In New York, in almost every studio I had, my office became part of my studio, even if it were in a niche or something, so that if I wasn't actually working, I was still looking at what I was doing. If I was on the phone with someone, or if I was writing something. And that was really important. The other thing that I miss terribly is, when friends would come over, and in New York there were always people in the house, in and out of the house every day. I don't mind seeing what I'm doing, better look good in the process. I mean, you can't make chicken salad out of chicken shit, and you'll probably have to edit that out, but that's a real basic law of aesthetics. So, if it doesn't look good at every stage, you're screwed. But so I never mind, people around when there's work in progress, but what I like is hanging out with people in there where we're not talking about art, where we're just hanging out, and that is a very rare occurrence upstate. Also, my books are in the house. I like my books to be near me. I got a thing about that. So that was the other thing that I had to get used to. Oh, it sounds like I'm a total weirdo.
No, I could totally understand. I lived overseas for a while, and it was the thing I missed.
Wow.
Yeah. You don't have your books.
Yeah.
Did your parents were supportive of this bent, were they?
No.
No?
Sorry.
Well, last month I had Rodney Allen Greenblatt. When he was three, he had developed this drawing thing. Uh-huh. So his parents bought him a beret.
Oh, fabulous.
Yes.
Well, my mother, my father had zero interest and was horrified by the abstract paintings. When he visited me at Skidmore, and I had big paintings. I was so honored and thrilled to have these paintings around the campus, and he said he would have felt a lot better if it was a bowl of fruit. So, and my mother, oh God, I don't know if I should say this. Well, my mother, you know, I mean, I had piano lessons. I had art. Actually, I dropped out of art school at the age of 8, and which was very daring at the time, at which I will tell you. But she did. But what, her idea was that I was supposed to marry somebody that, you know, and so that would be able to buy these things. I wasn't supposed to make the stuff, but I was supposed to be sufficiently educated to be able to shop. That was the deal. But, you know, but the thing of dropping out of art school, oh, God. I'm 8 years old, and I live on 79th Street. That, there's a great big street on 79th, and the art school, which is actually in a magnificent Beaux-Arts building on 71st and Broadway. It's a landmark at this point. And that the school was on 71st and Broadway, so it meant I had to cross two big streets, 79th and 72nd. And I had a governess, and I was supposed to wait to be picked up. So one evening, and it was cold, it was dark, there was this teacher, this old lady in a smock, that approached me as I was painting, and she picked up the brush, and she said, "No, dear, not like this, that, like this." And I just stood there, horrified. And as soon as she walked off, I packed up my little wooden box. I left the painting on the easel, and I walked home by myself across the two big streets in the dark and everything, and never regretted it. I mean, but also when I taught, I would never put a hand on a student's work, ever, 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 ever. I mean, I really don't think that's, you know, the way to get somebody to get something to come out of themselves, you know.
Right. So in a way, she was your savior.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, there is always a good way of looking at things, not to sound too much like a fruitcake, but that would be definitely the upside of, you know.
So you were up on the Upper West Side.
Yeah. Didn't realize that Chagall had been until like maybe a year before I was born or something. I think Chagall lived around the corner. You know, I mean, when I was 9, I wanted to move downtown. And it really didn't dawn on me how many artists were up there. It, you know, like I didn't know until I got older and read stuff that, oh my God, all these people were up there. I was only aware of the opera singers because you could always hear them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So as soon as you got out of college, then you moved back to New York.
To 9th Street.
Yeah. And started painting there.
Yeah, actually, when I got out of school, the first place I had to paint was very hard because I didn't have a studio at first. And a friend let me paint in her apartment in the East Village. And then I got my first studio very shortly thereafter. I got my first studio in a Stanford White building. You're not going to believe this. It was an office, okay, on 20th and 5th. Beautiful Stanford White building. And high ceilings and everything. I mean, amazing.
Did you ever, speaking of the East Village, did you ever connect with that scene when the East Village started?
I probably connected with every scene. Yeah, but I didn't live in the East Village, but certainly, you know. And I mean, this is the thing about New York is that it's like when worlds collide, you know. If your life goes in a certain direction, you may be, you know, in your own professional world, of course, which for me is the art world, but there's a crossover into the literary world, into film, into theater, into fashion, you know, absolutely, music. I mean, I really, and music in terms of contemporary music, rock and roll, classical musicians. I mean, it's like the whole world is there. So, I mean, this is the way I grew up, and that's the way I always lived. And that's, you know, for me, I mean, I'm a New Yorker. That's It's not unusual.
Now, how did you become a teacher, an art teacher?
I guess I don't really regret a lot of stuff, even though I have a lot of opportunities for regret, like a lot of people. But one thing I always wonder about, you know, when I was a kid, and I was 2 years younger than everybody in my class, straight through school. And so when I was a kid, I turned my nose up at graduate school. Looking at that now, I think that's amazing, because I didn't know another artist my own age until I was 30. I knew a lot of people in the art world, a lot of marvelous, wonderful people who treated me extremely well, and that's why I have an enormous empathy for young artists. I really, really do. I mean, because I was treated very, very well. But when I started showing, I met other artists, and a lot of them were teaching. And, you know, I got invited to give lectures, or, you know, I had a friend that was running a program at the Brooklyn Museum. I swear, I mean, it's unbelievable, but, you know, because the art world is like this. I think one of the first lectures I did might have been at Yale in the graduate program. Can you imagine? And I didn't have a graduate degree. In those days, the shows got the jobs, and I was showing. And as I said, I developed friendships in the art world, and people invited me to talk or to guest lecture or guest teach, and that's how it started.
Did you enjoy it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. No, I really, that's a really major part of my life, and I'm very proud that many of my former students are really great friends of mine. That's a cheery thing, indeed. I mean, I don't even think about there having been students at a certain point, you know, but which is great. You know, there's none of that. It's not like that. They're friends. But, you know, when I think about it, I think that's good. I like that. And because, you know, I mean, my ego as a teacher was not about making a bunch of mini-me's. You know, my ego as a teacher depended on holding the mirror up, getting that person to see themselves and perform at the highest level of articulation that was possible for them. And, you know, if I could get someone to do that, and you know how hard it is. I mean, development is not easy for anybody. You know, you have to have a lot of sympathy for, you know, human foibles and screw-ups and all of that sort of thing. Yeah, I liked teaching.
And then you taught full-time at Parsons?
You know, my hours at Parsons would have been considered full-time at Harvard. At Parsons, they were considered half-time. So I often had the privilege of being offered some amazing jobs that you can't apply for. I had for a year at a time, like I had an amazing job at SUNY Buffalo in the art department, where I taught undergrad and graduate, flew up there every week for a year, had a job like that in the graduate department at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. It was fantastic. I kept my job at Parsons when I did that. That was wacko, because it took me a whole semester to get used to that much teaching in a week.
Do you have a sort of lesson plan as an art teacher?
Well, you know, if you're teaching at university, you write courses. And some of the programs that I was invited to teach in, they specifically asked me, this may surprise you, but for SUNY Buffalo, I wrote a course called Intermediate. It was a multimedia requirement, actually. It was an undergraduate requirement, and they did everything, including shooting film. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a conceptual art course, essentially. And I that was part of the... I was, my hiring was predicated partly on that. And I was always really, my courses were always heavily imbued with the humanities, which freaked out a lot of kids at Parsons at first. They didn't think they were going to have to read, you know, as part of the homework. But I never liked disengaging that. And, you know, and I've written bibliographies of art and literary theory and criticism, starting with Aristotle, going up to contemporary writers. I've written a bibliography of narrative film for visual arts students, which, you know, I mean, I did that for school. All of those were used in teaching as well.
You're pretty much of a film buff, I take it.
Oh, yeah. I'd rather be sitting in the dark looking at big pictures than doing pretty much anything else.
Nowadays, do you rent Netflix or something like
oh,
that?
Oh, come on. Yeah. Totally Netflix. Yeah. Yeah. I had to cut down the Netflix thing, which every day I think about increasing it again, but I really had to cut it down because otherwise it'd be a total wastrel. I'd just be sitting there looking at movies, you know. And I can watch the same film over and over and over again too. That's another thing. So,
who are your favorite directors these days?
I couldn't restrict it to just contemporary. That would be hard to do, but Scorsese would be probably number one for me. Oh God, I'm going to blank on this one. And there's so much that I love. I mean, you know, everything from Kurosawa to Douglas Sirk. So. And I also have a taste for B movies. Absolutely. And I do love the movies a lot.
And also you read a lot.
Yeah, I read a lot. I read mostly literature. I don't read nonfiction that much, but I do read nonfiction occasionally. But mostly I'm a literature nut. I mean, but again, there are contemporary writers that I love, and I'm also a Shakespeare nut. I'm just becoming familiar with Frederick Tutton's work. I love Mary Gateskill. I think she's amazing. And, you know, but, you know, I read a lot of things. I love Edith Wharton, Dickens, you know, crazy about Dickens.
Do you think that stuff finds its way into your work, into your painting?
That's a really interesting question. Because here's the thing. I have to read at breakfast or I can't eat, okay? So that means I have to read before I work. Now, it's not a literal translation, but reading at the beginning of the day for me is an induction to work. Sometimes looking at certain passages in film is also. Sometimes looking at an art book is. That doesn't mean that I go into the studio and I paint what I just saw in a film or what I just read in a novel. I should have mentioned, speaking of contemporary writers, Ted Mooney and Jaime Manrique, both of whom I've painted and who are dear friends. And, you know, and believe me, the work is great. Great work, you know, that it's so wonderful to be able to, I mean, for somebody that loves books so much, to be able to know sometimes the people that wrote them. I love Angela Carter. I never knew her, and she's no longer alive, but, you know, she certainly would be a contemporary writer. I love Philip Roth. I reread Salinger recently. I mean, it's like, I don't know where to... I'm all over the place with this. Flaubert is on the kitchen table right now also. So it's like all over the place, you know. You mentioned Henry Miller. I love Henry Miller, you know.
Does this also go back to your childhood? You're always a reader?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one. My mother got a few things right, and that was definitely one of them. She always introduced me to good books, and she told me, and I really believed it, and I know she's right, that books are our friends. And I believe me, I know that's true. I even leave certain ones out so I can see them. I leave certain ones out on the table. Because it's like the way people put photos up of friends. I must sound like a complete nut.
No, not at all.
I just have to see them there. I don't know if I'm answering anything about the paintings. Going back to what we were talking about more recently in terms of how you can't plan a painting, or at least I don't. With the recent work, there are things that, mercifully, I still don't really understand about it, which means, you know, I'm going farther in a certain direction, and I can keep going in that direction. There's one thing that I have an ethic about painting that's really important to me, which is and also the given has to be that someone wants to look. But I really believe very strongly, I mean, this is my work ethic, if you will, that if someone looks at my work and they have no background in art history or, you know, critical ideas or philosophy of art, if they don't get a visceral response from it, if it doesn't communicate, then the painting's a failure. Because my intention is that the work, as long as somebody is inclined to look at it, that they should be able to connect with it on some level. And let me make the disclaimer that I do believe that works of art have particular and intended meanings. I don't go for that, you know, nonsense, that art appreciation nonsense where the painting's going to mean whatever you think it means. That's not really true. On the other hand, when I was teaching, I would ask my freshman students when I would send them to a museum to look at something, to please not read anything first and please not to get those headphones, because I wanted them to be aware of their own reactions, whether they hated it, whether they liked it, whether they were indifferent to it. You know, I really wanted them to have a sense of how they were responding to the work. After that, you know, mitigating ignorance is not a big deal. You know, you can find out what was intended. You can think about that, and here's where original thinking comes up. You can think about that in response to your own, in relationship to your own response to the painting. All of that is valuable. But here's the other thing. I believe that every image, no matter how representational or how purely abstract, is loaded with meaning, and that meaning can be communicated. And in my work, there is a range of imagery from pure abstraction to, you know, absolute representation, recognizable imagery. They don't all mean the same things. They mean different things. I mean, Leonardo and Rembrandt don't mean the same thing, you know, any more than Pollock and Mondrian. They don't mean the same thing, you know. And so I really, there's not a lot that I object to, but I definitely object to the concept that that nothing can really be communicated. There are certain deconstructionist philosophers that I used to insist that my graduate students read them so they could understand what, you know, what the flaws in logical argument were, you know. So, you know, so I really do believe in, you know, that imagery is loaded with meaning. And I'm also not the kind of artist that is going to shrug off the viewer. I mean, I'm not saying, oh, I just do this for myself. I'm compelled to do it. You want me to tell you why? I can't answer that question, okay? But I'm keenly aware of the audience. And I will sing for my supper. I'm not going to ask anybody to look at something of mine if I, you know, have nothing to give them to look at. You know, you got to give the folks something to look at. My job is to seduce with images, okay? That's what your job is if you're a painter. And I, you know, but it's like anything else. You pick up a magazine. Yeah, you leaf through the magazine. What catches your eye? There's no, not necessarily a logical basis for what might catch your eye, but that's the thing you're going to read more about. That's the thing that you're going to want to find out more about. So, you know, that's basically where I'm coming from, and I really try to build into the painting a level of interest, both in terms of how the painting can communicate dramatically and also how it can communicate across boundaries of educational background, age, cultural orientation. You take a Rembrandt, you can have, you know, a suburban housewife and a 9-year-old that may have a peak experience in front of a Rembrandt. No question about it. Does that mean there's nothing left for other painters or scholars or historians? Of course not. You know, I mean, so I am hoping. I mean, it's like Shakespeare. Those plays, they played by the side of the road. You know, it wasn't just the queen and the court that got to see those plays. You know, they pull up in a wagon and do it, you know, right? Do it in the road. To quote the Stones, you know, but and that's where I'm coming from. You know, I'm, you know, maybe I'm not so democratic in my thinking as that might be, because, you know, whatever. But I do think it's important to provide that possibility of communicating across all kinds of lines, and that I see that as my ethical responsibility. And the other thing is, the way the paintings are made, I'm really devoted to the idea of making a richly complex, well-made thing. So, you know, it's not a one-shot deal. You can come back to it. Hopefully you see something you didn't see the last time, etc. So if you even get to live with it, it won't bore you to death. It won't disappear on the wall. Like, you know, I'm not going to make the comparison anything. A great colleague of mine loves it when I said this, but I'll say I'm dreadful, but I'm not mean.
I woke up in the middle of the night two nights ago and turned on the television, and it was all about the new Barnes collection.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God.
It actually looks pretty. I was horrified. I thought, you know, it was that great place. But it looks like it's really
I've seen great. Some good reviews of it. I've been heartened by seeing that, you know, because it was very, very sad, you know. And there are things like that. You know, I've talked with friends about this recently. When I went to Skidmore, people would say, "What's your hometown?" And after the first couple of times, I realized the image that flashed in my mind was the front steps of the Metropolitan Museum. So when they changed the front of the building, I didn't take it too well. I don't take it well when they move things around. They moved the Whistlers at the Frick. I was horrified. How could they do that? They put them in the wrong place. It was perfect where they were. I mean, it's like, oh, my God. And, of course, I get completely sociopathic at the Met because, you know, I grew up 152 years ago. There was nobody in there, right? Now you go in there and it's like, you know, a cast of thousands. And all I can think of is everybody out of my museum. It's terrible. But, you know, also, of course, they've moved things around at the Met. And even in the case of certain paintings that I don't think are so great, but I loved when I was a kid, I feel pretty snarky about that they were moved. You know, it's like, it's very jarring. This is really, this is the one place I feel like I can go home again. You know, so the Met did a wonderful thing. I don't know if you want me to tell you about this, but this had to be, I'm going to say this was very, very early 70s. The northeast corner of Fifth Avenue that had a beautiful limestone mansion, like the, I recently told this to a friend, very much like the one, like the Frick, that style of building. And there's another one right across the street from it that still exists. But they tore it down. I used to stand there and wait for the 79th Street Crosstown bus and look and fantasize about what the rooms must be like. And I would look at the plantings that they had, which weren't a lot because it was the railing, the balustrade was very close to the building. But still, there were things in there and you could look, you know. And when they tore it down to put that ghastly, oh my God, talk about aesthetically bankrupt, the thing that's there on the corner now, the Met, and I think it was Henry Geltzel, or I'm sure it was Henry, made a little booth, a little chamber out of black cloth, and you walked into this little black room, and there was an endless loop of the wrecking ball taking that building down, and a soundtrack of a bell tolling. Yeah. So, you know, we don't like to see things moved.
That's right.
So, certain things, you know, not good.
Thank you, Stephanie Rose. The Eternal Return, Portraits by Stephanie Rose, will be on view at the Albany Institute of History and Art from August 25th through January 27th, 2013. Here, by the artist's request, is Gluck's Dance of the Blessed Spirits, played here by the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Neville Mariner.